It was 17 years ago next fall that I entered the University of Oklahoma as a freshman. And I'm supposed to give part of a testimony tonight, and we'll start right there. I, at that particular time in my life, by the time I got to OU, I had pretty much put behind me any kind of a spiritual life. I really did not know the Lord, but I had grown up in a religious home and had been to church. I think I was born in the nursery. I never really remember a time that I was not at church. And I play the piano, of course, and in a little bitty town, when you play the piano, then you're the church pianist from the time you can stand up. But I was baptized twice, baptized when I was 6 and then again when I was about 16. And I really believed in God and really, in many ways, desired to be a Christian. I heard testimonies about people that knew Christ and wanted to be Christians and all of that. And I wanted to, but I never could seem to do it. I believed that a Christian was a person who loved and believed in God, and I did, and who lived a good life. And it was that second part that I couldn't do. I tried. I suppose I must have tried to reform my life 50 times in the first 17 years. Because I would feel bad about how I was living, you know, and I'd tell God I was going to do better, and I was very serious. Many times I'd go forward in front of the church and rededicate my life based on the fact that I was supposed to have been converted when I was 6, and then again when I was 16. And I was very sincere, and I meant it, and I was going to try to quit cussing for a few days or quit being ugly to people or just, you know, quit doing anything that I thought I shouldn't do. And I really tried. I really did try. And it would last 3 or 4 days, and then I'd be right back because there was no power. I was just attempting to reform my life. And even if I had pulled it off, some people can reform their lives, there would have been no joy. That would have been just a reformed life. So by the time I got to OU in the fall of 1968, August of 68, I had pretty much decided that whatever there was about the Christian life, I could not seem to find it. So I pretty much put it behind me. But the interesting thing is, I was in Dittmar's house that year, and I don't even know if Cross Center is still open, but at that time Dittmar's was a man's house, and then it became a woman's house, but so it was a man's house then. I had 2 Christians in my dorm, both of whom were very active in the BSU and had started to hang around with Max and the troops and get some help. Now, neither of these guys were Baptists. Sam Bishop was a Methodist. Bunny Hill, that's Bunny, B-U-N-N-Y. Now, before you laugh, you have to understand he was an all-state fullback and an undefeated Golden Gloves boxer. So before you walk up and call him Bunny flippantly, you'd better count the cost. Well, Bunny was a full-blood Creek Indian, and he was a member of an ethnic church. He was not a Baptist, so neither of these guys were Baptists, but both of them had gotten active in the BSU. And they started sharing with me. And I was so confused at that particular time, I really didn't know. I told Sam this. I said, well, Sam, I don't know whether I'm a Christian or not. You know, I said, man, I've been baptized twice, and I know a lot about the Bible and stuff. And he said, well, Mike, there's a verse in the Bible that says, by their fruits ye shall know them. And he said, when you look at your life, do you think your life has the fruit of being a Christian? Now, that's what you call directive counseling, you know. And I guess that it didn't. Well, during the course of that year, well, I had all kinds of problems in my life. I was basically a pretty happy person. I always had been. But I had some real problems. I was headed towards some real moral troubles. Had begun when I was about a 7th or 8th grader. And was moving right along the line. And I had a rotten self-image, and people with bad self-images usually end up being very shy and withdrawn or very mouthy, and I chose the latter part. I've always been funny, could always say funny things, but I just developed a rapier tongue just to hack and cleave everybody that I came in contact with, really for no other reason than the fact that I was basically insecure, and it somehow made me feel better if I could leave them bleeding on the ground. You lose a lot of friends like that. But, you know, you're always the center of attention. And that's what I needed. So all of that was boiling around when these 2 guys began to share Christ with me. And, you know, the interesting thing was they really loved me. They knew the kind of life I was living, but they took me places with them. They'd take me. Remember when we used to go out to the Cerebral Palsy Center, Max, and hold Sunday school for the little kids? I don't know whether we still do that or not. But they'd take me out to that Cerebral Palsy Center, and I'd play the piano and pick those little kids up and hug on them and tell them stories about Jesus, which I knew. And Sam and Bunny just loved me. They weren't too, you know, when I said something funny, they'd laugh. They weren't too holy to do that. You know, if it was funny, they laughed. They didn't condemn me and make me feel like that I, you know, had no place in God's kingdom. They just loved me. In fact, I walked in on Sam one day, and I happened to see his prayer list on his desk, and my name was number 4. And I said, Sam, you know, as much as we've been through, I think I'd be one or two at least. And he said, well, Mike, you've got a lot of needs, but there's some guys in the dorm even worse shape than you are, so we've got you down on number four. But it was sometime during that fall of 1968 that for the first time I began to clearly understand what a Christian was. And I really don't remember all that happened. But I was having contact with a lot of people. I met Bob Anderson about that time, and Brett Yon, Larry Woods, and Jack Owens, and Gary Winters, and a lot of other guys that were hanging around. Sometime during that fall, I understood for the first time that a Christian is not a person who just grits his or her teeth and tries to live right. If that was all a Christian was, God would have simply put up a list and said, keep those, keep these rules, and you'll be a Christian. But a Christian was a person who was willing to believe in simple faith that Jesus Christ had died for us. Nothing really left for us to do. We weren't going to live good enough to earn salvation and just receive it from Him. And I understood that, I guess, November or so. But the problem was, they also explained to me that when Christ comes into your life, He comes in as Lord. Now, I was all excited about this being forgiven of sin. It was this lordship I wasn't too fired up about. Because I had been directing my life, or at least I considered that I had been for a number of years, and I was not overly inspired to turn my life over to somebody else. So I had to think about that for 5 or 6 months. And I can remember many times men and women laying in bed at night in that dorm room, looking up at the bottom of the bunk of my roommate up above me, just staring into the darkness and thinking, you know, Jesus Christ has done everything there is to do for you. And He is calling you. Well, March 16, 1969, Saturday. This coming Saturday will be 16 years. I went to church that morning in Del City and responded at the invitation, went forward at the invitation and told the pastor that I wanted to become a Christian, and he prayed with me and everything, and everybody came up and shook my hand. But it was really that afternoon when I got back in the dorm and I was sitting on the third floor, you know, or the second floor where my room was, looking out the window. It was really that afternoon that I think I genuinely opened my heart to Christ, just looking out the window. And I think everything began to come home for me. Now, the interesting thing is, because I had grown up in a Baptist church and had heard a lot of testimonies, I really expected something to happen. You know, I expected an angel to come down and sit on the desk or something. I didn't know. That's why it's dangerous to give experience-oriented testimonies, because people hear those and think that that has to happen with them. Well, nothing happened, except for the fact that the word began to spread through the dorm that I had gotten religion, because I had made that public profession of faith that Sunday morning and was baptized Sunday night. Well, about 3 or 4 days later, and this probably is one of those turning points in my life, Max brought a group of guys into the dorm. Max, I don't know whether you remember that or not. Bob, you were probably there, and Brett was there. And it turned into be just a little dialogue between the Christians and the non-Christians. And I went. And in fact, it finally turned into be a dialogue between Max and one other guy. So there were about 20 of us sitting around listening. We were probably divided, you know, 50-50, both kingdoms. And and I was just scared spitless, you know, because the word had begun to be out on me that I had made some kind of really. And these are the same guys, you understand, that the previous Friday night I had been drinking and running around with and chasing women and just really having a great time. And and now here they sat, and I was not going to say anything. And finally, it just kept going on. And gosh, I guess that debate or dialogue must have gone off an hour and a half. And finally, I just had to say something. And I stood up, and I was scared to death. My socks were rolling up and down. And I blurted out what amounted to my first stammering, staggering public testimony. And I really do not remember very much of what I said. But I said something and sat back down. And really expected at that time to be hooted out of the dorm. But it was really very quiet. And nobody said anything. Well, that night when the meeting broke up, I was standing at the drinking fountain getting a drink of water, and Joe Graham, who had been one of my buddies, came up and put his arm around my shoulder and said, "That took guts," and turned and walked off. Well, that was the night, really, that I took my stand, I think, for Christ, and I'm so grateful for that, because I think if I had not taken that kind of a public stand that early, it might have been much easier for me to slide back. But now my name was on the line. And from this point on, gosh, 17 years, it's really hard to know what to talk about in terms of testimony for you, because it's pretty arrogant to assume that anybody's interested in anybody else's life story. And I'm not going to be so vain as to assume that. So to try to pick out some things you might be interested in is a challenge. Let me try to pursue this thing from three directions. First of all, from that point on, I began to experience the faithful grace of God in patiently growing me in the Christian faith. My first 2 years were pretty much disastrous. I mean, my life was like a roller coaster. You know, now there were a lot of changes that had taken place. I quit swearing and quit doing some of the gross things I was doing and all of that. So the external things dropped off quickly. But boy, I still had one foot, you know, had both feet really firmly planted in midair as far as my commitment went. I was holding on to the world as tight as I could and yet running all over the country with this Christian music group giving my testimony. A terrible identity complex. So I came across in the dorm like a religious fanatic. And I'm afraid my testimony those first 2 years in the dorm were, those next 2 years rather, were virtually wasted. But it was near the end of my junior year that everything finally began to come together. And God used an interesting experience. I've shared this with some of you, I think. There was a guy in my dorm, his name was Joe, another guy named Joe, and he and I had become good friends. Good friends. Well, we were spending a lot of time together, and I think we were together every day and every night. We'd go out to McDonald's about 11 o'clock when we should be studying, and we'd be eating together and things like that. And we were just good friends. Now, Joe had never heard me swear or never seen me do anything real gross, you know, that we associate with grossness. I don't know. But that's about all you could say about it. Well, that night, Wayne Wright happened to come in the dorm sharing his faith. Wayne did that a lot. And of all the people he could have witnessed to, he witnessed to Joe. And during the course of the conversation, he mentioned there were some other Christians in the dorm. And Joe said, "Really? Who?" And Wayne mentioned my name. Well, about 10 o'clock that night. And I opened the door and Joe came in and he said, "Mike, let me ask you a question." I said, "All right." He said, "Are you a Christian?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "You mean you think Jesus Christ actually lives in your heart?" See, the only reason he knew that phrase is because Wayne had just used that on him about 2 hours before. He said, "You mean you think Jesus actually lives in your heart?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Huh." And turned around and walked out. Well, that was a very profound experience for me. Because in the darkness of my room that night, laying there on that bed and looking up, I thought, you know, I have run around with that guy every day for 6 months. And he has not seen one single thing about my life that is different. Oh, I don't drink and smoke and cuss and hell around, stuff like that. But there are a lot of people who don't do those things. A lot of people don't do that kind of stuff. And that's not the issue anyway, even if you do that kind of stuff. He could not see one significant difference in my life. So after about 2 years of pretty much rebellion and unteachable spirit and everything else, I went dragging back over to the BSU. I had been around for a couple of years and began to sidle back up to Wainwright and to Max and some others and said, "Hey, I need some help." Well, it was at that time, really near the end of my junior year and the beginning of my senior year, that things began to settle down and I began to grow. Well, the encouraging word is that's been 15 years ago, 14 years ago. I'm still growing. In fact, some of the most difficult years of growth have been the last 4 or 5. I have learned some very vital lessons, but I am so delighted to tell you that I'm growing. Because I was always scared to death that there'd be a day when I wouldn't. That I would begin coasting on past victories. That I would begin coasting on past messages that I'd preached and past people I'd led to Christ and past things I had done. And not have any fresh stories to tell. And I'm growing. Well, continuing in that same line, right when I got out of college, I was hired on the staff of my first church. And was very nearly fired from the staff of my first church. For a very simple reason. I felt like I was more spiritual than everybody else. Now, you have to understand, I was 23, so I had plenty of years behind me now and a lot of experience. I told the pastor of the church about the first month I worked for him, Bailey Smith, who is still at Del City. I told him he didn't know what in the world he was doing. Up in heaven, there were a couple of angels, and one of them said to the other one, "Shh, keep your wings still. I want to hear this." He just told the pastor of the state's largest church, a person who has been a pastor for 15 years, that he doesn't know what he's doing. And then to make it worse, not only did I not think he knew what he was doing, but I proceeded to be disloyal to him all over the church. Talk about him behind his back. See, I thought I was more spiritual than everybody else. The most dangerous person in the world is the person who thinks he's more spiritual than everybody else. Because he thinks he has a right to judge. So I began to judge the pastor all over the church and talk about him behind his back and everything. And I really should have been fired. But by the grace of God, we managed to work our way through that. And I asked his forgiveness in later times. And we came through that and lived through a couple of other things. I remember one day Wainwright took me out for lunch. This experience just sticks in my mind. Because Wayne had been kind of one of my spiritual directors. And we were always going out to lunch together, fellowship and stuff like that. And I thought, well, this is going to be a really good time. And we went to King's Food Host, which used to be King's Food Host. It's not anymore. They're in Norman. I don't know what it is now. Is it? Well, whatever it is. And we're sitting there eating lunch, just fellowshipping and having a great time. And all of a sudden, Wayne pulls his list out of his pocket and says, Mike, from some things I've heard about you, let me tell you what they are and you tell me which ones are true. 7 things on that list. He said, number one, I hear you think you're a little more spiritual than everybody else. Number two, I hear you're lazy. You don't like to work. Well, of course, I was immediately just blessed by the course this conversation was taking. But the fact of the matter is, some of the things he was saying, not all of them, but some of them were very, very true. And I have always been very grateful for people who love me enough to tell me the truth. Because there are many people who don't. And I have all kinds of good people who will say good things to me. And I appreciate that. And I get a lot of good things said to me. And that's fun and all that. But I have very few people who care enough about me or who are insightful enough to say, let me tell you something I've noticed and you comment on it. Well, growth. I don't have time to go into much more than that. Second area I'd like to deal with, just to show you God's faithfulness in the area of my marriage. Debbie and I met. She was a year younger than I am. We met our freshman year at OU. Very spiritual thing. We were playing touch football. And she went out to catch this pass. And I was playing defensive halfback. And I weighed about 220 then. About 10 more than I weigh now. And she probably weighed 120 pounds. She weighed about 100 pounds less than I did. And I never saw her and was running full speed and hit her with everything I had and just rolled her through the air. She was wearing braces. She cut her mouth on her braces. It was just really a romantic time. And that was the beginning of a very warm and wonderful relationship. But anyway, to make a long story short, and the reason I want to share that with you is not so much for my conduct during those next 2 or 3 years of our relationship or what there was of one or was not of one, but because of hers. Because, you know, one of the problems I had so much was dating. You know, my motto is, if it moves, date it. And that was true. I wish I was making that up, Max, but that's the truth, isn't it? And that's one of the reasons in those first 2 years I had so much trouble getting my life together. It's not that there was anything wrong with the girls I was dating. It's just that I was trying so hard, you know, to be, gentleman Jim on the campus that I was spending more time with young ladies than I was with the Lord. Well, during all this time, while Debbie was watching me, I knew, now please hear this very seriously, I don't mean it to be, you know, conceited or anything else, it's not a conceited statement, I knew that she loved me. And I had known it since the very first few months we met. But she would not admit that. And furthermore, often would not give me the time of day. Well, that hacked me, you know, because I... And furthermore, to make it more complicated, she had a real walk with the Lord. And gosh, I grew to admire her so much those next 2 or 3 years. We spent a lot of time together, even though we did not date. I was dating everybody else. And the more I grew to know her, the more I grew to admire her. And really even tried to develop feelings for her, and they just wouldn't come. I mean, I really tried. I thought, you know, God, if there's ever anybody that I ought to marry, it would be this girl. And I tried to fall in love with her and everything. It just wouldn't work. Did you ever try to fall in love with somebody? It just won't work. And finally, by my senior year and her junior year, when I was just about getting my life straightened out, our relationship had pretty much degenerated into it. We weren't even too civil with one another because of those pressures that were there. We came to the Glen this month of 1972, March of 72. And I was with another young lady. And it was during that week that God dealt with Debbie in a very real way and dealt with me in a very real way. And we got back from the Glen and she came over to see me. And we sat outside, and it was another one of those little turning points in my life, especially in this area, because she said, "Mike, there's something I need to tell you." She said, 3 years ago, when we first met, she said, "I gave you my heart then." And she said, "I know you've always known it." And she said, "But I just didn't want to admit it to you." And she said, "I think that's been unfair." Because she said, "I've been holding secret and dreams and plans for you, you know, kind of tying you to God in my life. Like, you know, God, you let me end up with him and I'll walk with you," that kind of thing. And she said, "I just want you to know I got all that settled in Colorado. And I'm going to walk with the Lord." And I thought, that's the end of this. You know, we'll part now and be good friends forever and all this will be behind us. And would you believe it? About 2 weeks later, I woke up in the middle of the night and thought to myself, you know, somebody is going to marry Debbie Spicer someday. And I'm going to be standing out in the audience someplace watching this and thinking, darn. Now, I'm sure there's a more theological way to say that, but that... And what I had wanted to have happen for about 2.5 years, all of a sudden, began to happen. And I really believe one of the reasons God did not touch my heart in the same time he had touched hers, first of all, I wasn't mature enough, you know. Secondly, we probably would have gotten married and we didn't need to get married that early. Well, we've been married 12 years come May. And the good news is we're still growing. And we have two little children, an 8-year-old and a 4-year-old. And they're, I have pictures with me if any of you would like to, like to see those. But the good news is we are still growing. Last year when I spoke in August to your leadership training group, I mentioned some of the difficulties that we'd had even in the last few years. We've always had a very good marriage, very easy marriage in many ways. We did not have many of the adjustments other people had. We knew each other so well when we got married that there just weren't a lot of surprises. But we had some, you know, we've had some struggles the last few years. But thank God we've worked through them and are growing. And that encourages me because I always wondered if there'd be a time where I'd wake up one morning and just find that the person I was sleeping next to in bed was just my companion and we happened to live in the same house and ate at the same table and that was it. And the good news is that's not it. And the better news is it doesn't have to be that way with you. And a third vein in the area of disciple making. I am a professor of discipleship. In fact, the guy that I was co-teaching with just left the seminary a few months ago. Now I am the professor of discipleship, which is kind of scary. There aren't very many of those people, and it's scary to be an authority when you don't know what in the world you're doing. And we have people writing us all over from all over the world saying, "What are you doing in your discipleship courses?" And it's the last idea. I mean, it is really scary. I get introduced like this is one of the finest authorities on academics and discipleship in America. And I think, oh, God. But I really wanted to trade my life for people. And during my senior year in college, the same age some of you are, and the first year out of college, God began to rivet that into my heart that I wanted to live my life in a worthwhile manner. As my friend Barry Wood says, it became to be true to me that it's not how long you live that counts, it is how well. And I wanted to live my life well. I didn't know how long I'd live. I'm delighted to have made it to 34. I hope to go a lot longer. But however long I go, whether it's another 2 weeks or 28 years or 50 years, I want to live it well. And I began trying to learn to invest my life in people. Now, to be honest with you, I'd like to tell you that those first 5 or 6 years from ages about 22 to 27 or 28 were really successful in disciple making. They really weren't. I did some good things and I helped some people. And there are some people around who name my name and say that I helped them. But really, it took me about a half dozen years to really get down the vision and the skills and the inward drive to train people. And I really don't know at what point I crossed that line, but about 5 or 6 years ago, it began to dawn on me, you know, I know what in the world it is I'm trying to do. And that's kind of scary. And it began to be revealed in the people I was working with, because now they know what in the world it is they're trying to do. And the original group of people I worked with in those first few years, very few of them are doing anything today. And a couple of the things I learned in disciple making, and I'll just leave these with you. First of all, I learned the primacy of evangelism. And I think one of the great errors I made in my early days of being, quote, a disciple maker, was I emphasized everything else and then tried to sneak evangelism in at the last. And it just does not work. You know, I'd teach my people how to memorize verses and have a quiet time and study the Bible, and we'd work on their character and everything. But then all of a sudden it began to dawn on me, they do not have a vision for the world. All they know is how to memorize verses and have a quiet time and stuff like that. Well, really, that stuff's really not that significant, if that's all it is. So about 5 or 6 years into the process, I began to reverse it. And the first thing I would do in training people is take them witnessing and get their feet wet. Have them share their testimony with a real live person. You know, I'd turn to one of them and say, tell him what Jesus means to you. Well, he'd suck all the air out of the room, you know. And then, but boy, they'd come out of there fired up and ready to win the world. And my whole emphasis on disciple making switched. Now, it's not that I'd been taught wrong. I'd been taught right. I just somehow managed to lose sight of it. And it's such a thrill now to see the guys that I'm training doing so well and to see the guys they're training doing so well. And the first thing they do with them is take them out witnessing. You know why? It's the first thing I did with them. They think that's how it's done now. They don't know any better. You know? The guy that I hired as an associate at the seminary, he's working with me in discipleship, is a guy that I've been able to work with some the last couple of years. And when he graduated in December, I asked him if he'd stay and work with me for a couple of years, just to get some more training and to do some things. He has been started meeting with this kid who was 17 years old. The guy's now 19. And the maturity in the life of that 19-year-old is staggering. And the guy is out witnessing. He and his girlfriend go witnessing on Saturdays. Can you believe that? Last Saturday, they went witnessing and led two kids to Christ on Saturday. Well, the reason is because David used to take him witnessing all the time. And BJ doesn't know any better. He thinks that's what you do. And he thinks that you go witnessing and you share your faith. His girlfriend has been a Christian, I believe, 4 months and has led 8 gals to Christ. Because she dates BJ and he does that and she thinks that's what you do. And you know, and BJ now is training his first man, and BJ's 19. So it kind of went from Max to Wayne to me to David to BJ and to this young guy that BJ's working with. See, that's really how it's supposed to work. Now, beloved, I'm not very old. I'm older than you are, but I'm not very old. And yet I think I've been at this thing long enough to know that that kind of a ministry, whatever else you're doing with your life, is worth investing in. You know, there are hungry people around. And whatever direction God's taking you in your life, that kind of ministry is worth investing in. And I strongly recommend it. Well, I think that's probably enough. I'd simply say to you, I kind of know where you are tonight. I sat in this great hall. I think this is our 9th or 10th conference, something like that. We were trying to count them up today. And I sat here in 3 conferences in college, just like you're sitting here. And I prayed for the future of my life, and I wanted to go build disciples and make disciples and everything. I know what you're thinking. And then the first year or two I was here, I didn't care anything about that. So I know where some of you are sitting tonight. You don't care anything about that either. But we're glad you're along. You know, there's hope. My first conference, I didn't take a stitch of notes. Everybody else was just writing feverishly, and I decided I'm not writing nothing down. Just to show them. And I sat under Leroy Iams' messages 3 times and never wrote down one thing. I should have been struck dead just for that sin alone. I mean, I just decided I'm not writing nothing down. just to show these folks. You know, so I know where some of you are. But I want to say to you, walk with God. You know, whatever it costs you, it'll cost you something. Whatever it costs you, it's worth it. Let's pray, shall we? Our Father, more than anything else, we fear being irrelevant in our world. God, we would pray that we might, if necessary, be hated, be despised, but never allow our lives to be such that we can simply be ignored, that people can dismiss us as simply not mattering. And Father, I pray that you'll use this week in a significant way in all of our lives to push us a little farther along the line toward following Jesus Christ. There's some special needs in the lives of these men and women. There are some here who are trying to decide for the first time, really, whether or not they want to walk with you. I pray you'll do your sensitive work in their lives. There are some who have made that decision and are kind of wavering back and forth now, trying to decide what that means. I pray you'll shed light on that for them this week. And then there are some that have been at that walk for some time. I pray you'll hone and sharpen their senses this week. Thank you most of all for Jesus Christ, that we are who we are because of Him. Amen.